parade, as you might already have guessed, meant different things to different activists, but everyone saw this day as a turning point for New York labor. Even the reporters were impressed.
Never before has there been such a display of worker solidarity. Never before have the Knights of Labor stood so boldly, so openly before the people.
For Terence Powderly, this was a watershed moment in the struggle to organize.
Look at what we've done. In so little time. No more secrecy. No more studied winks and handshakes. Today, all 40,000 of us declare ourselves to the nation. Today, we ask all working people, men and women, black and white, skilled and unskilled, to join us in this great march of labor.
Founded as a secret society in 1869, the Knights of Labor rapidly became the largest organization of workers in the nation. By 1886, there were over 700,000 of them. What did it mean to be a Knight of Labor?
I joined the Knights in 1884. William had died a few years earlier, and I had two daughters to support. I was glad to get work as a mill hand, but the pay was nothing. Then the girls all joined the Knights of Labor, and now we make the same wages as the men.
As a hosiery worker in upstate New York, Leonora Berry organized 927 sister workers. She led a successful strike and became the first woman to serve as a national organizer for the Knights.
You must devote every moment to the service of women. Take every opportunity at hand to right the indignities heaped upon them.
Mr. Powderly, over the past 11 months, I answered 537 requests from women who want to organize. I had 213 appointments. I visited nearly 100 different cities and organized new assemblies. I spoke at 100 engagements. Either I or my secretary, Mary O'Reilly, answered 789 communications asking for advice or information. I distributed 1,000 leaflets and answered 97 telegrams.
Well, now you can see why I say that women are some of the best men in our organization.
That's all well and good. But I've also been called a lady tramp. Some say the Knights are a vulgar, immoral society for encouraging women to organize. But I'm just a mother, a widow, an Irish woman, and a good Catholic. Like it or not, I am an honest working woman who fights for her sisters.
From the beginning, the Knights also welcomed the newly freed black workers. Most prominent among these recruits was Frank Farrell, a trade unionist from Brooklyn and an outspoken socialist. Known throughout the country for his oratory, Farrell was a machinist and engineer by trade.
I joined the Knights back in 1879 when it was still a secret organization. We called our assembly the Eccentric Engineers Association, and we had a whole system of secret greetings and codes for announcing our meetings.
Despite his prominence, there is little left in the historical record about Frank Farrell's early days in Brooklyn. Later in his life, in 1886, we do know that he and the Knights caused a national outcry when his New York Assembly, the most powerful in the country, chose him to introduce Terence Powderly to the governor of Virginia at the Knights Convention in Richmond.
We made the national headlines with that convention. Just my presence sparked a near riot at the Opera House. An entire New York delegation voted to leave the hotel and to stay with fellow Knights after I was denied a room. And I will say here what I said then. Mr. Powderly and New York's District Assembly 49 have immortalized themselves so far as the Negro is concerned. We have expressed our doubts about the rank and file of the order being ready to accept the Negro as a man. We hope our doubts are unfounded. For should we join together in wiping out race prejudice, the Knights of Labor will undoubtedly hold the future government of the United States in the hollow of its hand.
Just one goal in 1882. Another was internationalism. Once again, it was Matthew McGuire who led New Yorkers in support of Irish tenants who were being pushed off the land by escalating rents.
To the working men of all countries, to all trade and labor organizations, to the peasants of France and Germany, to the oppressed masses of Russia and Austria, to the farm laborers and mechanics of England and Scotland, to the disinherited of Italy, Spain, and Portugal, to the workmen of Belgium and Holland, to all who live and work in the dominion of monarchs, tyrants, and monopolists, pay no rent!
Pay no rent! Pay no rent! Pay no rent!
The no-rent battle of Ireland is the battle of the working men all the world over. For if we can free Ireland from tyrannical landlords, we can free our own workplaces from industrial tyrants.
It was a monster parade.
From Union Square, the marchers filed up Fifth Avenue with its grand mansions to Reservoir Park at 42nd Street. From there, thousands of marchers and spectators streamed into Wendell's Elm Park.
Wendell's Elm Park at 92nd Street and 9th Avenue was the largest private park in New York City.
50,000 tickets to the picnic had been sold for 25 cents each. Women and children were admitted free.
The crowd stayed until 9 that night, singing, performing, listening to speeches and reveling in the knowledge that...
Never have we made such a demonstration as today.
Oh,
Just 2 years later, at the third Labor Day parade, an even larger group of workers marched to Union Square. This time, behind Grand Marshal Frank Farrell, were many more African-American workers.
The last and most heartless difficulty to be dealt with and destroyed in this free land is race caste. Its citadel is in the late slave states. Thus far, we have been left to combat it almost alone. Reason and religion both show its flagrant inconsistency. In fact, it is at war with every principle of truth and right. God is surely raising allies for its effectual resistance and final overthrow.
Yes, the labor movement was becoming increasingly diverse. Labor journalist John Swinton noticed that among the Labor Day marchers in 1885, there was a contingent that marked
the first appearance of a new labor organization, the United Hebrew Trades. Leading the way was their corresponding secretary, Morris Hillquit, a socialist who arrived here just a year ago. Not far behind them was the largest array of women's unions I've ever seen at Union Square. In the lead were the militant carpet weavers and shirt makers, flush with the victory of their recent strike. And then the women compositors, shoe fitters, and dressmakers.
The determination of these women labor activists soon prompted the Knights of Labor to appoint Leonora Berry as special investigator for women's work. Other women soon followed in her footsteps. Fresh in the minds of these women trade unionists was the great victory in the carpet weavers' strike of 1885. Again, it was that dean of labor journalism, John Swinton, who knew best how to tell their story with a little help from Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade. Listen to Leonora Berry recite the story of the Yonker women's strike.
"Strike for your rights," she said. Wildly her shuttle waved, while round about the maid machinery thundered. "Down with your tool," she cried. Then they marched side by side, eyes flashing honest pride, gallant few hundred. Oh, what a strike they made! Was there a girl afraid, e'en though the varlets said, "Someone has blundered"? Weavers with shuttles deft, of every right bereft, nothing but strike was left. So struck the few hundred, dailies to right of them, weeklies to the left of them, slander in front of them, volleyed and thundered, charged at with shot and shell. But not a striker fell. Boldly they stood and well, noble few hundred. Oh, how they struck that day, striking to get fair play, striking for honest pay. Their wrongs are unnumbered. When can their glory fade? Honor the strike they made. Honor each noble maid, gallant few hundred.
The very next year, 1886, New York workers rallied to the Central Labor Union's call to enter politics. It was a difficult decision with little precedent, but the time seemed ripe, and the CLU pleaded with Henry David George, a labor reformer and activist in the Irish Land League, to be its candidate for mayor of New York City.
"First, I worked as an errand boy for Samuel Ashbury and Company. Then I sailed on an East Indian freighter. Before coming to New York, I joined the Eureka Typographical Union and worked my way up to the managing editor of the San Francisco Times."
On May 1st, 1886, 45,000 trade unionists in New York struck for the eight-hour day. There were boycotts and pickets all around the city. Tensions between police and picketers grew, as did prosecution of CLU members for strike activity. Calls for independent political action increased after the police attacked a group of musicians who were picketing their employer over at Tice Music Hall. In July, five unionists from the CLU were sentenced to Sing Sing prison for their alleged role in these labor actions.
"What a summer that was. The CLU leaders pressed me to run for mayor. I had my doubts about our chances, and I resisted. Then those Tammany men came and offered me a congressional seat if I stayed out. They said I couldn't win. But they worried that my running would certainly raise hell. Well, men, I said, you just relieved me of an embarrassment. I do not want the responsibility and the work of the office of the mayor of New York, but I do want to raise hell.
And with the help of such influential trade unionists as Sam Gompers, hell is what he raised.
Henry George and I became warm personal friends. It was George who taught me how to ride a bicycle. On long Sunday rides around the city, we would discuss all the important topics of the day. The single tax, the land question, trade unionism, socialism.
Perhaps it was on one of these bicycle trips that George told Gompers of his plan to run for mayor. We know that it was Frank Farrell who chaired a huge gathering of George supporters from 175 trade unions. Under Farrell's guidance, they adopted a Labor Party platform, reminiscent of the slogan seen here at the first Labor Day parade. After a carpenter nominated Henry George for mayor, Farrell stood up.
I second the nomination of Mr. George. Some say that we are too weak to go into independent politics. We are not too weak to elect our opponents to office. And with our platform and Henry David George, we will not be too weak to elect our friends. If we are not strong enough now, on our own heads will rest the blame for relegating our children to a state of slavery.
A few days before the election, Farrell, Gompers, McCabe, McGuire, and other CLU activists went back to Union Square. Even on this wet, chilly night in October, over 10,000 trade unionists and their families made a somber, silent procession to show their determined support for Henry George.
This government of New York City, our whole political system, is rotten to the core. Industrial slavery must end. Why is there such abject poverty in this city? What forces young girls upon the streets and our boys into the grog shops and then into the penitentiaries? How can we lower these ridiculous rents? I am one of those who believe that only with the vote can labor obtain what it justly deserves, and I am one of those who know that this is the supreme object that working men should seek in politics.
George's views found vigorous support among a remarkably wide range of New Yorkers, men, women, immigrant and native-born, skilled and less skilled workers.
How many times have I been asked to say whether or not we are a class movement? And if so, what class are we? Well, the working class, to be sure. Do you ever ask yourselves how it is that the working men created wealth with their labor? But why, then, is the working class everywhere, the poorer class? It is that some men devise schemes by which they can live without working.
Now you can see why immigrant New Yorkers who had to raise families in their dismal apartments supported Henry George. He inspired more public activity by women than the city had ever seen. Not allowed to vote themselves, working class women urged on their husbands, their brothers and sons to vote for Henry George, and they collected carloads of pennies to finance his campaign.
Everyone is for Henry George. His campaign is inaugurating a sort of humanitarian renaissance in the city.
Who else embraced this humanitarian renaissance? There was Jose Marti, a cigar maker and Cuban revolutionary. In the 1880s, Marti was in exile here in New York. He counted among his strongest supporters the militant Cuban cigar makers of New York and Tampa, Florida.
Pero lo que en realidad tiene el himno es empuje, cariño, fe contagiosa y simpática que nos une.
The strength of the hymn lies in the thrust, the tenderness, the contagious and sympathetic faith which unites us.
Los trabajadores de Nueva York unidos por primera vez en un serio esfuerzo político intentan elegir corregidor de esta ciudad del trabajo a Henry George.
We are united to elect as mayor for this laboring city, Henry George.
Él es uno de los pensadores más sanos, atrevidos y limpios que ponen hoy los ojos sobre las entrañas del nuevo universo.
He is one of the cleanest and most daring thinkers that cast their eyes on the confused entrails of the new universe.
Sacerdotes lo ayudan y reformadoras que parecen sacerdotes. Lo auxilian con su palabra y su influjo muchos latinoamericanos.
Priests help him, and priest-like reformers assist him with their words and their influence over many Latin Americans.
And I now ask you, who better than Henry George puts this message before the voter?
George did beat Teddy Roosevelt, his Republican opponent, but he lost the election to the Tammany Democrat. Forever optimistic, it was John Swinton who found hopeful words for this defeat.
Pick your flints and try again. That is what the fathers said as they covered up the slain, weeping o'er the mangled dead. Keep your unions all intact. Fate will yet its gifts disgorge. Take to your hearts the coming fact. We'll make a governor of George.
Hooray!
Men will lose and men will win as they struggle day by day. Good goes out and good comes in. Let us, brothers, watch and pray. Lay this unction to your soul, workers by the bench and forge. Fate will bend to our control. We'll make a president of George.
Hooray!
As you know, they didn't. But even worse, just 2 months after the election, Sam Gompers and Terence Powderly were locked in a bitter battle that had disastrous consequences for labor's unity.
Terence Powderly and the other night leaders float like scum on the top of a part of the labor movement.
Sam Gompers is a drunkard.
He is a gin-guzzling, pot-bellied, red-nosed, scab-faced, dirty-shirted, unwashed, leather-assed, empty-headed, two-faced, rattle-skull, itch-palm scavenger in the field of labor reform.
This fight was nothing less than a battle for control of the American labor movement. Powderly and nearly 1 million knights failed in their effort to organize everyone into one big union. Sam Gompers' craft-based unionism gained momentum, and in 1902 topped 1 million members. Both men were dead years before industrial unionism came roaring back in the 1930s. What became of the others?
Frank Farrell. In 1890, I became the chief engineer at the New York Post Office. I joined the United Labor Party and represented my district. I continued to challenge the critics who denounced the Knights of Labor, for the fact remains that in my lifetime, no one did more to blot out color prejudice and to recognize the equality of races.
Leonora Berry, after we got the Factory Inspection Act in Pennsylvania, I devoted myself to the temperance movement and women's suffrage. Our victory reminded me of my earlier work as an organizer. It's a hard job, often very frustrating, too. You work and work and seem to be getting nowhere. Just when you feel that it is no use going on, something happens.
José Martí, el hotel donde me alojé en Brooklyn se convirtió en el cuartel general del Partido Revolucionario Cubano.
My Brooklyn hotel became the headquarters for the Cuban Revolutionary Party.
Después de trabajar 10 años como periodista para el New York Sun, comencé mi propio periódico, Patria.
After working 10 years as a reporter for the New York Sun, I started my own newspaper, Patria.
Compañeros trabajadores del tabaco, aquí y en Tampa me apoyaron.
Fellow tobacco workers, both here and in Tampa, supported me.
Durante los siguientes 3 años, viajé frecuentemente a la Florida, donde los trabajadores cubanos se manifestaban en favor de la independencia.
For the next 3 years, I traveled frequently to Florida, where Cuban workers rallied in support of independence.
Matthew McGuire, shortly after George lost the election, I moved to Paterson, New Jersey. There I was elected to the Board of Aldermen in 1894,
on the Socialist Labor Party ticket. I defeated my Democratic opponent by only 2 votes, 890 to 888. The Republican got just 323 votes. In 96, I was re-elected. Later that year, I went to London, where I represented fellow workers at the International Socialist and Trade Union Congress.
William McCabe, I continued to work as a compositor at the New York Herald. I was there 30 years. And in 1924, I myself ran for governor of New York.
These are just some of the people who marched over 100 years ago to Union Square. They were people just like us, coming together, trying to make things right, not just for themselves, but for all of us.
Shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Organize and fight, for the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong. In our hands is placed the power greater than ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
Things over, we are tired of toil for naught. With but bare enough to live upon and never an hour for thought.
You've been listening to Marching to Union Square, a musical play produced and written by Dorothy Fennell. It was directed by Mark Pleasant. Jeanette Vandevroom was musical director and singer. George Mann on guitar and singer. Our engineer was WBAI's Matthew Finch.
Marty Pottinger played the narrator. George Drance played Matthew McGuire, George Blissett, and Henry George. Arthur French played Frank Farrell and Jose Marti. Todd Griffin played William McCabe, Sam Gompers, and Terrence Powderly. Mary Newfield played the role of John Swinton, Leonora Barry, and a German reporter. This production of Marching to Union Square was brought to you by Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.